gonna spend the rest of my life telling this story, ain't I?
We know the dangers. Is it one person using it?
Alright, I'm good. Here we go.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Meadow. I'm your host, Joseph Carver. The Meadow is where we gather to discuss all things creativity and independent schools. This week, before heading out for holiday break, I had the opportunity to sit down with the Meadow School head of school, Jeremy Gregerson. Jeremy and I talk about his 16-year journey here at the Meadow School, his dreams of the future, and a remarkable fall semester. I hope you enjoy this conversation and have a happy holiday.
I'm good. Here we go.
So, Jeremy, before we start, the intro music is from a band called Hallelujah the Hills. That were Ryan Walsh was a guest on the podcast like maybe a month ago, but before we had him as a guest, we've been using the music all year. And I think the first episode we recorded, Tim Aldretti just started the episode by just, I don't like that music.
I have actually heard that intro.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have listened at some point.
All right. So we're going to say it here that Jeremy Gregerson's a fan of Hallelujah the Hills. So if
that's great.
So well, listen, Jeremy, thanks for joining us on the Meadow. This is, I think, the seventh or eighth episode of the podcast that we initiated and began largely as part of a conversation that you and I had about sort of sharing some of what's happening outside the Meadows campus, but also addressing larger trends about innovation and creativity in schools. And it's become this sort of broad canvas for all of those discussions. But I think it's great as we're getting into winter break to be able to sit down and talk to you a little bit about your headship at the Meadows School and what's happening at the Meadows School, what the things that we're most excited about going forward, and just sort of talk about what happened with the fall. So, but I would like to start, we start every episode of the Meadow like we start all superhero stories with an origin story. So for people who are listening that are not familiar with how you became the head of the Meadows School, can you just walk us through the short tour of that?
Well, like many heads of school, I was birthed fully formed into the headship. I actually started my educational career wanting to be a writer. My forte was, or at least my focus, was poetry. I learned early the harsh reality that no one has made money off of writing poetry since Frost, so I quickly had to find another way to support myself. So after graduating with an MFA in creative writing at University of Michigan, I found a job at a boarding school, sort of by accident, and said, okay, this is a thing I think I can do. I don't even remember who told me that I ought to think about teaching in independent schools. It just became something that I did. I signed up with the headhunting agency and got a call from this little school in Wisconsin called Wayland Academy. Under 200 students, high school only, mostly boarding, and immediately was thrown into figuring out how to fill 5 days a week, five periods a day, teaching, you know, American literature mostly, and also coaching baseball and basketball. I was a dorm parent. I was a supervisor and a chaperone and all kinds of stuff. So I immediately was just sort of thrown into that triple threat lifestyle where you have to do everything. And right. The irony, and not an irony, I guess, but the uncomfortable reality was that I was only 6 years older than my senior students.
Right.
Right. And so I was put in a position where I was in authority over these kids. And, you know, in retrospect, I was barely out of high school
myself.
Still
listening to the same music that they were listening to.
I was introducing them to bands that they thought were really cool. I had a lot more cachet back then.
Yeah.
I was cool.
I've got bad news for you about getting older, let me just tell you.
It doesn't get better, does it?
No.
My Simpsons references are just not landing the way that they did in the 90s.
Exactly. So once you made the decision that you were going to go into education, was the direction of independent school purposeful, or did you have like a fully formed idea about what independent school education looks like? I mean, it sounds like you got the completely typical independent school, boarding school experience in your first stop, which was you do everything. You're a part of everything. So.
Yeah. No, I fell in love with independent schools there because I had so much autonomy. It was really like it felt like people were paying me to do something that I wanted to do anyway, yeah. which is talk about books with smart people. Mm-hmm. And so when I left there, I left thinking, you know, I really want to teach at the college level. I want to become a professor. And so I went off to University of Oregon in their PhD program and was miserable. Really didn't like it. Wrote term papers that got good grades, and then no one ever read again. You know, spent hours and hours and hours doing research and writing papers, and understood that I had fewer readers for my essays than I did for the poems that I was publishing, mm-hmm. which is embarrassingly small readership.
Right.
So I just sort of became disillusioned, and I was really enjoying teaching freshman comp. So I was like, this is clearly a sign. I need to go back to schools, mm-hmm. and I need to go back to teaching. And I knew that I wanted to stay in independent schools because I knew that I wanted that freedom to design my own classes yeah. and to be able to do things the way that I wanted to do them. And ultimately landed a job here at the Meadows 16 years ago.
So before we head straight into the education part of your background, we've talked to a lot of creative people in the last 7-8 episodes. And I'm always interested in knowing sort of like what their process is for writing. Do you still write? Do you dedicate specific time to writing? Like, what's your approach been for like harvesting the creativity?
What I have found with two sons is that I have a really hard time being selfish with time.
Mm-hmm.
And so my writing has suffered. I haven't been writing as much because it's hard to turn to your wife with a 2-year-old in the house and say, I'm gonna go do something totally selfish for a while. I'm gonna leave you completely alone with this kid who is an absolute mess, right? he's a danger to himself and others at all moments. And so you can't just let him be on his own, right? Yeah. And so she spends so much time with him that when I have free moments, I not only feel an obligation, but I miss him. So I spend a lot of time with the boys. And so I learned that when my older son, Jack, was when he was 3 and 4 and started hanging out on his own, doing his own thing, I got back into writing, and I was writing every day again. So I'll wait. You know, it'll still be there. I do write, but I don't have the time to dedicate to it right now.
Do you think, I know Jack, and Jack's a reader. He's a real reader. Do you think that was something that came from just sort of the way the home is set up? Or do you think that was something that was handed down? I mean, he really when you meet people who are real readers, you kind of know who they are right away.
Yeah.
And he clearly is one. What do you trace that back to?
It's so funny because if we have any arguments at all, it's about the amount that he reads. Mm. And I don't think he reads enough.
Really?
At all. I'm like, what are you doing again with that Minecraft or like video Legos is what I call them because it upsets him that I call them video Legos. I know he's a reader. He does read. He reads. He keeps up with his reading without being badgered. So I get that. What I don't see him doing is losing himself in a book.
Oh, right.
In the way that I used to. I used to be like, I'd fall into the next chapter and I would just consume stories. And he reads, and he enjoys it. He does some of it out of a sense of obligation for school, and he knows that that's an expectation. But I think that his mom's a reader. I always have 2 or 3 books going. It's the expectation. I mean, my house is basically, the main rooms are basically a library.
Right.
You know, every surface is covered in bookshelves. So I think kind of by osmosis, you know?
I think that the thing about, that you mentioned about the way that, you know, my generation, your generation read versus the way this generation read it, it's really hard not to attribute some of that to screen time. It's really hard not to attribute it to the way that we absorb media now.
I think that's totally true. I have sit downs every year with 8th grade families, mm-hmm. families, 8th graders and their parents talking about their high school plans. And we always run through their standardized tests. And without fail, students' lowest score is reading comprehension.
Oh, wow.
Almost without fail. And that is generational. Mm-hmm. And I sort of look at them and I say, why do you think this is? And they sort of shrug and they look sheepish. And I'm like, you got bored, didn't you? And they burst out laughing because, yes, they got bored doing the reading on a standardized test.
Yeah.
And I said, the only way to fix this is to work on your stamina. You've got to stay in a book longer. You That's can't a real thing. Put it down.
It's a real thing.
And look, think about yourself. I mean, when I was in graduate school, I could read for hours and hours and hours and not pick up my phone and wonder, you know, who was maybe trying to contact me or thinking about updates of any kind. I mean, I could lose myself in my work. And that flow state is harder and harder for me to achieve because of the instantaneous nature of, and the ubiquity of email. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've stepped away from the vast majority of my social media accounts, but I still find myself with attention deficit.
Yeah. It rewires our brains. And
does.
That reading muscle is a muscle. And if you're not working, absolutely. Yeah. So, but we'll probably circle back. I'm sure that we'll talk a little bit about technology, but so you came to the Meadow School and in your first role, you were in the upper school.
My first role was I went from teaching college freshmen at Oregon to teaching seventh and eighth graders. And if that wasn't a whiplash, I remember that one of the reviews of me by those students on ratemyteacher.com was, he's too impatient. He should go back to teaching college kids. And man, that hit home because I had a hard time learning how to teach those kids. But I had great mentors. Some of them are still in the school right now and are unbelievable teachers. I mean, they're just cut out for that age group. And so I learned a lot about classroom management. I learned a lot more about structuring because mm-hmm. with high school kids, you can kind of roll into the classroom, be the smartest person in the room and hold their attention. Middle school kids don't care how smart you are.
Yeah.
Right. They don't think that your insights are particularly penetrating. They're like, what do I need to do, you know, to get through this class period? Yeah. Because most of them haven't sort of been turned on as intellects yet.
Well, and even the goal, you know, I see Meadow students as being pretty focused and we'll talk about that more, but the collegiate goal,
yeah.
You know, it seems so far away from
right.
them, but boy, when you get to high school, those kids are like, I got to zero in. I got to make the most of my opportunities. I've always felt like it was an easier scenario to manage because it becomes almost self-selecting. The
yep.
kids are competing against one another.
And themselves, yeah.
So it makes a big difference. So you were in middle school and then eventually moved to upper school English? Or
yeah, it was the very next year, in fact.
So you didn't go all the way back to college, but you did, go to high school.
I took a step in that direction. yeah, and so the next year, the head of school called me and said, not only do we need you to teach upper school, we need to buy a prep from you. And so I taught two sections of AP English in every single sophomore. Hmm. And that was a really tough year, but super, super rewarding. And I'm still in touch with a lot of those sophomores because I had the opportunity to teach them both as 10th graders and as 12th graders when they came up. So that was, I think, the class of 09.
Shout out for the class of 09 kids.
Yeah.
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 And so you spent some time as the middle school director and assistant head before becoming the head of schools.
Yeah, I was in a role in the upper school that I just loved. I thought I was made for it, and it was an academic dean role. And I was doing work regarding writing across the curriculum. I was doing student-facing work on really thinking about homework loads and how effective our teaching practices were. And I was loving it because I was still teaching two classes and I was doing all of this administrative work that I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. So I did writing across the curriculum. I was doing scope and sequencing. I was trying to bind together the grades 6 through 12 in a curricular way. And my head of school at that time said, look, you've seen the middle school. You've been close to the middle school. I think you're the right person to lead the middle school. I turned that job down, I think, three times. I just said, I really don't want to do it. I'm doing the work I want to do. I want to be in the classroom. I want to be teaching these seniors. And ultimately, I felt like I had a clear enough picture of what needed to happen in the middle school that I felt like I was going to be successful at it. And we had some problems with homework loads, and we had some problems with retention. We were losing a lot of kids after eighth grade. They were walking away from the school, and I thought I had some solutions. And so I took on the role, and I ended up only doing it for 2 years.
So what do you think the significance of having been in multiple communities and multiple roles has been for your headship? Like, do you feel like it's just positioned you better to understand what's happening in divisions or to be able to, I mean, what do you think the advantage of that is versus coming into a community as a new head?
Yeah, I think for a school like the Meadows, which is young, which is really aware of its origins and really familiar with its own founding traditions, that it was really beneficial for me to see the school from a lot of different directions. I think that a head coming in from the outside would have a much harder time getting the lay of the land in that way. And so I was fortunate. You know, there's difficulties that come with being an internal hire, being somebody who comes up through the ranks, but there's also the benefit of getting to know the people, you know, getting to know what different individuals' motivations and priorities are, and making sure to try to serve the needs of everybody who's here. I already know who's here, you know, and so that made the transition a little easier. What I was really lacking, however, was a knowledge of how a lot of other schools work, and I gained a lot of that knowledge through my association work later on.
Yeah, it's almost certain that an outside head would not know all of the moves for the 12 days of Christmas dance that happens at the winter.
Yeah.
Right before we go to break. So I think there have been a bunch of instances since I've been here. I've been here about a year now, and there have been a bunch of things that were so beyond what I would have expected. You know, obviously coming into a community, you say, oh, I don't know all, but Meadows, you landed on something there. The Meadows has some very specific traditions, and it probably helped you to avoid some of the potential, you know, potholes for leadership, that you knew what some of those were and which ones were really important to the community and which ones, you know, were steeped in the tradition that makes sense. So let's talk a little bit about the Meadows School, because I'm certain that some of the people that will be listening are less familiar with the school than others. So tell me about the profile. If you were telling this, you were explaining this school to a candidate, how would you describe the Meadows School?
The Meadows has about 900 kids, pre-K through 12, co-educational, it's secular, non-sectarian. But more than anything else, I think that what defines the school is a real respect for a respect for challenge and higher learning. You know, I think that from first grade up through 12th, we really attract kids, and we really promote in kids this desire to learn more. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really helps a kid thrive at this school is that just sort of intrinsic motivation. And I'm not here to say that every child is above average at the Meadows School. Not everybody is always motivated by learning new things, but there's a piece of that in the vast majority of our kids that I think is really inspiring.
It's challenging because as a pre-K through 12 school, you admit three-year-olds, and because of the beginning school, you have three-year-olds. So you admit three-year-olds, and you have to sort of have an eyeball towards what that 14-year-old is going to look like. What have you learned from the admissions process as a head that helps to avoid misplacing students?
Well, I think that shifting our understanding of what makes a Meadows student successful has been really helpful. Mm-hmm. And really saying, look, this is, like all independent schools, our school is not for everyone. And really, you know, approaching this process with humility and saying, hey, you know, we're not going to get it right every single time. And there's no way to test a three-year-old and say, this is the kind of learner you're going to be when you're 14 or 15. But to really approach every kid and every year with, hey, are we still the right spot? Are we still the right community for you? Are we still going to help you thrive as a learner? And that's just not going to be the case for everybody. And that's not a judgment on our school. It's not a judgment on the individuals. But I think that we're getting better as a school at being willing to say, this is who we are, and this is who thrives, and this is how we can help you thrive.
So the school, you talked about sort of being a Meadows student, or what the profile of a Meadows student is. What do you consider the profile of a Meadows student?
Yeah, I think, like I said before, I think a curiosity is necessary. But I've also seen, you know, a willingness to work. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a big piece. And I don't want to say, we've gotten a lot better over the course of the last 5 years, that sort of grinding for the sake of grinding, right? I've long said the point of an education is not to grind students into a fine powder, right? The point is to change their lives fundamentally. But that said, learning is hard, right? Learning takes time, and it takes energy, and it takes stick-to-itiveness, and kids who are here and who find success at the school are willing to sort of roll up their sleeves and engage in work, right, in the hard work of learning.
There's a balance that has to be struck between rigor and love of learning, you know. And it's not that rigor can't inspire love of learning, but it definitely has the potential to grind some of that down. And the thing that's most transferable, you know, for students, I think, going into college is that. It's the, are they positioned to love learning? That's probably the biggest, if not the largest, maybe the second to most important factor in their success at the next level is, yeah, can I throw myself into this and feel good and passionate about the work I'm doing? And then do I have the tools once I do that, right, to be purposeful? Because, like, I, you know, as a student myself, I had the passion for it. I even at a really young age, I respected bright people. I was just like, I want to be around bright people. This is what fires me up. But I didn't have the work habits at all to sit and really just do the work. And some things came easy, that made it okay. But as I, you know, as we moved up through the levels and things got more competitive, the thing that really caught up with me was, oh, I don't have the tools to really structure my work.
Right.
So the meta school, it sounds like, is focused on kind of doing both of those things at the same time, understands that they're bound together.
When it goes well, yeah. I mean, and it's always a balancing act, mm-hmm, right? Because you don't want to confuse that rigor with misery,
right?
You know,
right,
that's not what we're here to do. Right. And sometimes you can tip over into a bad time. But I will say that the most transformational educational experiences that I've ever had have been the most challenging. Mm-hmm. And that's not a sense of sort of naive accomplishment. You know, I did it, I survived it. They were really transformative educational experiences where I struggled and I didn't know if I was going to succeed, and I came out the other side knowing something. And that's what I want to provide to kids, is the opportunity to sharpen your skills, to sharpen your learning muscles against hard surfaces.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of what inspiring a love of learning is, because you don't get a love of learning when everything is easy.
Right.
It's just,
no, that's the quickest route to being disengaged.
Yeah,
eventually,
exactly,
you'll get bored in that situation.
Right.
We've had a lot of conversations about this in pursuit of excellence, you know, the Meadow School in pursuit of excellence. And I, in our conversations, I've said before that I think that we really have to emphasize the pursuit part. The natural inclination as a parent, and I'm a parent, is to focus on that excellence part. I'm going to create or help create this being that achieves, you know, academic excellence, athletic excellence, you know, performative excellence, whatever those things are. And what tends to happen in some cases is the word pursuit just gets into smaller and smaller font until it's just in pursuit of excellence.
Right.
And I think in a perfect scenario, it's pursuit is the largest font in pursuit. So what does in pursuit of excellence mean at the Meadow School?
It's our motto.
I know that. I'm from
For me, as a leader, it's always meant the willingness to adapt, right? The willingness to change. And that's difficult, but that's what education is fundamentally walking into a situation hoping that it changes you, right? And if you're walking into a situation hoping that it changes you, that's what the pursuit of excellence looks like, is saying, I'm going to have to transform myself in some way to accomplish this task or to acquire this knowledge. The pursuit of excellence is really about the unending or sort of the ever receding horizon, right? That you got to be willing to continuously adapt. You got to be willing to continuously change, challenge yourself, and get better over time. And that's hard, yeah, right? That's a really difficult proposition, because we are a very successful school. We are a very, we're one of the best schools in the region, if not the best, at doing what we profess to do. And it's really easy to say, why on earth would you continually pursue change when you're doing such a good job where you are? And I think that's always the challenge, is to take in, hey, you know what? We need to celebrate the quality of educational experience that we provide, while at the same time understanding that we can do a better job tomorrow, or the next day, or the next quarter, or the next semester.
Yeah, it's not a perfect analog, but I always think about Blockbuster in those moments. Like,
yeah,
when people were saying, we should get into this streaming business, and Blockbuster was like, why would we change anything about our model. We are the best at what we do in the world. The biggest, right. The best, the most profitable. And now it doesn't exist anymore. Simon Sinek, Alex, you know, who obviously helps record and produce the podcast, despises. But I find him interesting. He has a book, and it's called The Infinite Game. And he says that what the mistake we make sometimes as learners is to focus on a finite game that right. has a set of rules and winning that game. And that game looks like becoming the biggest, you know, video rental company in the world, right. instead of the infinite game, which is like, what, you know, what's next? What's next? What do we have to do next to continue to be of service to? And in their case, it's obviously a customer, but in our case, it's the students and their families. What do we have to do that we're not doing? What's to prepare them for what's coming next? And it's overused, I think, but we are preparing students for jobs that don't exist yet.
Yeah.
That's the reality. So we do have to remain a certain degree of flexible. And I love that. I think that the people, that the professionals that I've interacted with at the Meadow School really do understand that pursuit as being something that's ongoing, you know, and that's what we're preparing students for, is the infinite game. So so speaking of that, we're just wrapping up the fall semester. I'd love to talk about some of the things that happened this semester that have been highlights of fall 2021. I'd be remiss, especially for people who aren't in the Las Vegas area, to not mention that the Meadow School's been really effective during this pandemic at staying open, keeping kids in schools. And independent schools as a whole have had a better adaptability rate than public schools, partially because of size, partially because of their financial structure. But the Meadow School, even among those independent schools, has managed with fewer disruptions. And coming into this fall, we thought, you know, we had a pretty good handle on where we were. Can you talk a little bit about how that the processes that you put in place got us through like the last year and a half and still, you know, going? We're heading into almost it'll be year three in 4 months or so, that how you've managed to maintain sort of school as usual as best as possible in these circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, we've been really fortunate, right? We've been really lucky, and sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. But I look back not to last year, but I look back to March of 20, mm-hmm. during the real terror of this thing, where we didn't know what we were looking at. We didn't have a really clear picture of even how the virus was going to be transmitted. Right, the real fear was that is it gonna be airborne? And looking back, that's sort of foolhardy at the moment, right? Like, of course it is now, and we all know this. And in that moment, when we shut down the school, I think I shut school on a Thursday, and the leadership team and I started meeting that Monday, and not about how we were gonna deliver. Like, the teachers were already figuring that out. Mm-hmm. How they were going to deliver an educational experience remotely. But we started almost immediately to plan, to start to figure out how we were going to launch school in the fall of 20. And a lot of it was just really war game scenario planning and saying, what if this, what if that, what if this, what if that. We borrowed heavily from a lot of schools across the country in terms of, there were those who were out in front of this faster than we were in terms of their publications, and we were looking at what the best practices were going to be. And I have to credit a couple of people on this campus who really pushed my thinking, because I was like, okay, this is enough, this is enough, this is enough. And then all of a sudden somebody would say, if we can't test, we can't run school. And I'd be like, what do you mean? We can't run school. And I would think about that, and then we partnered with a local hospital and got surveillance testing running. And so I think I credit a lot of our success with that sort of yes and approach. Like, everyone was willing to plan. Everybody was willing to do this. Everybody jumped in immediately. And not only did we have fewer disruptions due to illness, but we didn't have the widespread dissatisfaction and fear on our campus that so many schools did. And I credit that with the leadership. They all, we just sort of stepped into this and said, we're going to do this because this is what we believe is best for kids. And the faculty were afraid, and there was a lot of trepidation, but they all stepped in and said, okay, yeah. We're going to do this. This is the right thing to do for kids. And You know, it has paid off so far. We've had minimal disruption.
I got here in January a year ago, but obviously I'd been here a few times in the fall prior to that too. And I remember just being here for the second week and talking to my family that were still back in Florida because they stayed for a few, as you know, through the school year. And I said, it's the hardest thing to explain because I'm very aware that the pandemic is still ongoing, but when I'm on campus, I just feel like school is what's ongoing. Like it just had a sense of normalcy that did not exist where I'd come from. And that was remarkable because I had the fortune of going back and forth for those 5 or 6 months. So I was seeing the other side of the coin. And I mean, I don't do this in the podcast a lot, but I just think that we need to take a moment to acknowledge everyone, all of the faculty, all of the parents and the leadership at the Meadows School to acknowledge what an incredible job they did to provide a sense of normalcy when that was unattainable almost anywhere, but also to educate the student population. The students were responsive, they mm-hmm. were respectful, they were masking, and they were doing all of the things they were supposed to do. So somehow the leadership and the faculty in this school managed to educate young people and their families without creating the kind of environment where it was, you know, a permanent state of exception where everyone was always, you know, couldn't be physically or mentally present. It just felt like school.
Yeah.
Which was pretty remarkable.
It was, and it remains so.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had a question this morning where we're re-examining and re-looking at and thinking about our protocols. We had a child who had a possible exposure over the weekend, and, you know, is that two negative tests, and then you can return, or what does the quarantine look like? And I mean, it's just an ongoing thing where everybody is willing to say, okay, where are we? And we've adapted throughout this thing. So I would come out, as you remember, with updated protocols mm-hmm. almost every 4 to 6 weeks because the CDC would change what right. they knew and the school would change what it was doing in accordance. And I think that being just willing to say this is an unknown, and we're going to do what we think is right by kids every day was the key.
Yeah, it was remarkable, and I haven't given it a lot of thought this fall just because we've been busy and things have been going on, but I remember it being this immediate impression I had, and I just think it's a testimony to the community. So, but going back, so fall, this has been like a really, really fascinating semester at the Meadows School. So many things going on between the arts, between athletics, you know, new additions to the faculty and administration, a construction project. Can you want to just walk us through some of the kind of highlights of the last 4 months?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it has been incredibly busy. I sort of look around and I'm shocked that it's halfway through the year.
Right? Yeah.
We had what was probably the most successful varsity athletics season of the school's history, where every sports team, virtually every sports team, either won the state championship or was runner-up. I think the only exception to that was our small but mighty cross-country team, which did have representation at the state final mm-hmm. meet. So,
and in the case of women's golf, this was their first year.
Yeah,
right?
It was their inaugural season, and they won the state title out of the gate.
Yeah, amazing.
You know, So that's one thing, and that's really great success for those kids. But, you know, we've seen across campus, I hesitate to say that it's been a return to normal, but the whole community has said in one way or another that we're doing this, and that was sort of what we've carried over from last year. Now, I'll be the first to admit that I'm more impatient than anybody else on campus to put this thing behind us so we can get back to growing the school and doing the things that we want to do. But at the same time, having people return to campus this year, still masked, still doing what we can to distance and make sure that we can contact trace, still doing all the things, but making sure that these kids have a really stellar experience has been, I think, the most rewarding thing. But in addition to that, we're also in the midst of expanding our upper school, adding much-needed STEM space to our middle and upper school experiences, much-needed science lab space to our lower school. And we've had three record-setting freshman classes in terms of size over the course of the past 3 years. And so we just needed the space. And so we're on target to finish an expansion of the upper school building this summer.
Yeah, I saw they're finally opening up the pathway back down to the lower school. They've been pulling back, you know, some of the fencing and putting some back.
No, I don't know if they're going to do that.
I don't know if it'll be available to get through, but you can see through it again for the first time in like 6 months, which is great. I was super excited to see that. I also think that I've got to know the folks in the science department and robotics and engineering departments pretty well. And what's great about that is that people like the Trujillos and Mr. Misick, they're operating at this incredibly high level with students already without these facilities. And so they've sort of learned to be flexible and learned to work with, you know, in less than ideal circumstances. There's nothing better than when you have people like that who are performing like that to then be able to give them the space they need to really do what they want, you know, what they want to do right. So that's, I'm super excited about that STEM expansion.
But one note on that, though, that I think is really unique to this school compared to a lot of schools that I've seen is that we went through this period in the last 10 years where schools would build maker spaces or fab labs or call it what you want, right? The sort of name du jour, and then sort of looked around and said, wait, what are we going to do in here? And what I'm really excited about this engineering space is that we have programs that are going to be taking up, making that their home and thriving in them on day one.
Yeah.
Right. That's exciting because we don't have to try to reverse engineer how to use a space like so many schools have had to. We've actually, we know what's going in and those programs are going to benefit, and the schools and the students are going to benefit because we've already got the programs ready for the space.
Yeah. And you also see that, when speaking about independent school growth at large, you also see a lot of the times they build these programs and they're seeking someone to staff them, and people don't realize that that's just as iffy a proposal as the building itself. You don't know that, but you've got people leading those programs already that understand the culture, that are part of the culture, that have been building it for years. And so it's sort of like a minimal risk, enormous reward.
Absolutely.
Growth, which is awesome. So you've had incredible athletics, you had great STEM construction project. What about the arts? What's the arts growth been like this year?
I mean, we just had as you mentioned, our holiday assembly, which, you know, it made us all a little bit nervous to crowd that many people into the gym, but this is an experience that is really central to the Meadows experience. It's, I think, everybody's favorite tradition of the year, where we all get into the gym in our ugly sweaters, and the arts department has a bit of a showcase, and they do holiday music and programming, and there's, performances by the cheer teams and so forth. And what really got me about this year was it was the biggest crowd of students performing that I think I've seen in 16 years. And that's with, you know, everything from lower school orchestra and the lower school Meadows Singers, which is a chorus, to the band programs, the jazz band, to our orchestras in lower, middle, and upper school. It almost felt at times that there was more kids performing than there were watching.
Right.
And that's what I want out of this school experience, is that I want every kid to be able to have the opportunity to participate in athletics at the highest level. I want everyone to feel like they can pursue a creative pursuit at the highest level. And you don't get that unless you have you present them with the opportunities. And this sort of showed that Michael Orman, who's our director of the arts, is really doing a great job of growing that culture of participation. Just getting kids into saying, I'm going to raise my hand, I'm going to learn how to play this instrument. So many of those kids in upper school band and orchestra had never played an instrument before they got to the Meadows, and that's where they picked it up. So it's exciting stuff.
I mean, the quality of the performances across the board. I know that Alex and I, it was sort of our first time at being at this, and we're both just sort of like, those are middle school kids. Like, that's incredible what they did. And I mean, hats off to all of the folks throughout the arts departments who pulled that together. And of course the, inimitable Tim Burris leading the cavalcade of stars. It's something that very unique to the Meadow School. And we talked a little bit about that. There's these traditions that really matter. I think, for me, I know you mentioned athletics, but one of the highlights for sure was seeing the school at the Allegiant Stadium.
Yeah.
And not just the game, which was incredible. It was a great experience. You can imagine what it would have been like for those kids that are on the field, but also just that morning in the parking lot, the gathering of just people there celebrating being a part of the Meadows School. It was just such a, you know, it was such a great experience for people. I think it's hard sometimes, there's a cognitive dissonance to realize that all of that's also happening while these other things are happening. And that goes back to what I said. It just feels like school. It feels like things are going the way they're supposed to. So it's been, you know, we've got students right now crammed into every space taking their midterms and getting ready to head out for holiday break. And they're all so focused on what they're doing right now. And I know that you are focused on with a much longer vision. So given how things are going at the Meadows School, what is it you see down the road for the Meadows School? What's the future of the Meadows School look like aside from bright and full?
Yeah, I think, you know, my biggest goals right now have to do with continuing to grow the arts department. You know, I think that our athletics department is doing a really amazing job. But I've said, and I'm sure you're tired of hearing me say, that I just fundamentally reject the notion that you have to be bad at something to be good at something else. Mm-hmm. You know, no one at Stanford ever said we probably shouldn't try very hard at football because it'll lower our academic standing. That doesn't happen. And if you reject that sense of mediocrity and say, hey, look, if we're a great academic school, we can't really be that good of an athletic school. Mm-hmm. Or if you're in the school play, there's no way that you can start on the softball team or whatever it happens to be. I just reject those ridiculous binaries. And so building these auxiliary programs at the highest possible level is just central to my philosophy of leading schools. And so we've got the athletic program. Like I said, it had its best season in the school's history. I want the same for the arts program. And I think that what that looks like for me, if I were to be clear about what a great arts program looks like, one, it's participation, like I said a minute ago. But I think that it's also balancing creativity with technical proficiency. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is knowing how to play an instrument and play a song is one thing. Writing a song is another thing entirely. And I think that the arts are a place for that kind of creativity. And I would love for us to be a place where kids are not only performing at a high level, but are also creating at a high level. And I want to be able to provide them that experience. Beyond that, I think that the next thing that the school is focusing on doing a really good job of is supporting the learners that we accept, right? We accept kids who we think are going to be a good fit for this school. And our job is to make every student who's capable of getting B's at a very rigorous school figure out a way to get A's, right? And that's a pretty silly way to put it, right? Because it's not supposed to be about grades, but you see what I'm saying. It's really about how do we make sure that every kid has the support necessary to succeed at the highest possible level. And whether that looks like learning support, whether that looks like counseling services, whether that looks like the appropriate financial aid in a need-based way, whatever that looks like in terms of student support, I want us to be the very best school in the world at doing that. So a kid who comes here has every opportunity to thrive at the highest possible level in every facet of an educational experience. Nothing big.
Yeah, so you've got, just meager goals, nothing to it. I have one or two more questions before I let you go, and they're a little bit less about the specifics of, you know, the operations of the Meadows School and more just sort of takeaways that you've had as a leader. You have, I think that independent school leadership has to strike a balance between sort of honoring the school that they're at, but also being a part of a larger independent school community, right? Because that exists. These organizations like National Association for Independent School and so forth, those all exist, and we all do. There is a sort of, in some cases, informal, in other cases, formal alliance to one another. What is the balancing act that as a head that you use to make sure that you're respecting, honoring the purpose of the Meadows School, but while also pushing yourself forward a little bit or using others to say, oh, I see something here that I feel like can be a part of us. Is there, like, what does that process look like in your head and in your calculations?
Well, I appreciate the fact that you describe it as a balance, because I think there's a, the Oscar Wilde quote is be yourself, everyone else is already taken, right? So if you think about that in terms of schools and the footprint or maybe thumbprint of a school is truly unique, and they need to be honored for what they are, because they grow up around unique circumstances and unique leadership and unique community members. But at the same time, no single school has broken the mold, or maybe what I mean to say, no single school has cracked the code, right? No one does everything perfectly. Mm-hmm. And there's always ways to go back to the school's motto. You cannot be in pursuit of excellence if you reject the notion that you have something to learn from another school. And for me, that's not necessarily about a national association. That's saying, okay, what can we learn from schools who really do great work around student services? Mm-hmm. Where can we get better at things that we've identified that we want to improve? And I think that you can do both. Again, I'm somebody who's just not all that interested in binary thinking. Mm-hmm. And I think that a both and proposition is how school leadership should work.
Well, listen, I appreciate you taking, 45 minutes of time right before you head out for break. We've been wanting to have this conversation. We can certainly have many more conversations like this, and I hope that we do.
I look forward to it.
But in the interim, I do want to extend my congratulations to you and your alma mater on their performance this football season. The University of Michigan is once again going to be competing for a national championship. Is that probably the first time in your adult life that that's happened?
Oh, yeah.
For sure, right?
In my adult life, yeah. I think that before I would ever have considered going to the right. University of Michigan, they won it.
Yeah, right.
Share it with Nebraska in 97 or
something.
Yeah,
I mean, and I think that's a long road. But we appreciate you sitting down to talk, and hope that you'll come back again.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I look forward to it. Thanks. Thank you.
Okay, that'll do it for this episode of The Meadow. We'd like to thank our guest, Jeremy Gregerson, the head of schools at The Meadow School. If you're interested in learning more about The Meadow School, you can find us at www.themeadowschool.org. If you have an opportunity, please visit and subscribe to our podcast or leave a rating or review. And we will see you in the new year at The Meadow.